Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, it is no myth. Canada does indeed have a maple syrup reserve. It's in Quebec. And guess what? It's kind of tapped out right now, down to just 7% of what it was a few years ago. So what's going on? And could we face a syrup shortage? Following that bridge disaster in Baltimore on Tuesday, we get a sense of just how well Canadian bridges are protected in the event of a ship strike. And we get the latest on efforts to rescue a stranded orca calf in a remote part of Vancouver Island, left there after its mother died. So how will they try and free it and get it to reunite with its pod before it's too late? You may know actress Mary Elizabeth Winstead from one of the many successful movies and series she's been in, from Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, 10 Cloverfield Lane, Fargo, and Star Wars Ahsoka. Well, now she's teaming up with real-life husband Ewan McGregor for a new series called A Gentleman in Moscow, based on the 2016 international bestseller of the same name. And Winstead joins me to talk about the story, working with McGregor, and find out why so many of her close friends happen to be Canadians. Globe and Mail Ottawa Bureau Chief Robert Fife is with me to talk about the opening day of the public hearings at the inquiry into foreign interference. We'll find out how optimistic he is that we'll learn the answers to questions surrounding allegations of interference by China in two recent federal elections, and how much the government knew about it and what they did to prevent it. But first, Canada's population surged to 41 million people over the past year, most of it driven by a huge jump in temporary residents, including students and people on work permits. They now account for 6.5% of the population. Ottawa now says they want to reduce that to 5% because of the strain it's putting on the system. Is that feasible? We find out. When someone asks me what the population of this country is, part of me still thinks it's about 35 million. I mean, I know it's more now because the number has been going up and going up fast, but I still think of it as like 25 million, 30 million, 35 million. Guess what? It's now 41 million. Just 9 months after reaching 40 million, we've cracked that new threshold. As of Wednesday morning, it's estimated 41 people now call this country home. That's according to StatsCan's live population tracker. The population, the speed with which Canada's population is growing was also reflected in new data released today by the federal agency. Between January 1st of 2023 and January 1st of this year, Canada added 1.27 million inhabitants. That's 3.2% growth, the highest since 1957. Patrick Charbonneau is chief of StatsCan's Center for Demography. He says the increase was largely driven, in fact, almost all driven, by the number of temporary residents.
About 98% of population growth was explained by international migration. And in fact, it's mostly the temporary immigration component that is driving population growth in Canada.
There you have it. Temporary residents, of course, include international students, asylum seekers, and people here on work permits. Last year, their ranks grew by slightly more than 800,000. That's the second consecutive year that temporary immigration accounted for the bulk of our population growth. As of January 1st, Canada was home to 2.67 million temporary residents, near doubling in just 2 years. They now make up 6.5% of this country's population. That's a lot. Well, last week, Federal Immigration Minister Mark Miller announced that Canada will now set numbers for temporary residents as part of its annual immigration targets starting this fall. That in a bid to ease a cost of living crisis. The federal government plans to decrease the number of temporary residents to 5% of Canada's population over the next 3 years.
Recently, Canada's temporary resident volume has increased significantly, now reaching up to 2.5 million or 6.2% of our population in 2023. Therefore, in our levels planning, we'll be including a target in order to reach an adequate volume of temporary residents that we can welcome. As a starting point, we are targeting a decrease in our temporary residents population to 5% over the next 3 years.
Mark Miller there. There is concern, of course, that with few checks and balances in place, that it's putting tremendous strain on housing supply and infrastructure in this country. Chantal Iannicello is an immigration and refugee lawyer in Montreal, and she joins me now. Chantal, thanks for your time tonight.
Hello.
That is, that's quite the quick jump to 41 million. Does it feel like the situation from where you sit, does it feel like it's gotten a bit out of control?
Well, I was a bit surprised to hear this number. It's the first time I hear it myself. But I think it's important to understand that there are some people here as temporary residents, as was mentioned in your introduction. doesn't mean that all those people will eventually want to stay here on a long-term basis. And I think we really have to make the distinction between refugees and temporary residents, and all those people are different categories of people, and we tend to put them all together. But there's government policies that will limit the temporary residents as we need them in the country, as the government sees that it fits or doesn't fit what the targets that we need for different years. But for the refugees, we have a moral obligation to protect people that are they have a situation of persecution in their country, and that should be accounted differently in the statistics, I believe.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the refugee thing because it is the one-year anniversary of the closing of that Roxham Road irregular border crossing, and we'll get to that. Where are the temporary? Why has there been such a surge, do you think, in these in temporary residents? Because it feels like this number has gone up really quickly.
Well, there was a point in time where the Canadian government decided that we should welcome more temporary residents for various different reasons. I believe that a lot of universities depend on international students to finance their university. They also pay a lot of fees for apartments, food and everything. And we need a lot of temporary residents here to palliate or to mitigate the shortage of workers that we have. So government will have policies that, you know, will increase or diminish the amount of temporary resident that we will accept every year, depending on the situation in the country. And right now we hear that the shortage in rent is something that is very important and it's affecting people. So now they're deciding to reduce the amount of people that they will welcome here. And that's something that they have the right to do.
Indeed. Obviously, the demand is out there. I mean, you know, the way to come to this country, either as a student or as a temporary worker and so on, obviously, the demand is out there to want to come. And certainly the organizations here, whether they be labor or, you know, universities, have been granting them access, right? I mean, there's certainly a system in place that allows that many people to come here in short order. Mm-hmm.
Yes, correct. And the price also is attracting too many students compared to the United States, for example, or maybe some universities in Europe that might be more costly for them. We have many universities in English, even here in Quebec, elsewhere in Canada. So we have, I think we're on the market internationally to attract a lot of good students that, you know, value the degrees that we'll get here.
Right. From your experience, because we've been talking a lot about the affordability crisis, up close, are people struggling? Are people arriving here struggling as we think they might be with just the sheer cost of things?
I think that a lot of people get surprised when they get here with what the prices of housing is and different elements or items that they need. Yes, a lot of people do get surprised about that. They might not have expected that before they came here, but then they will face reality pretty fast.
Now, my understanding of what Mark Miller, the immigration minister, was saying last week was they'd like to reduce the number to 5%. Right now it's at about 6.5%. Is that easily done or is there a lag time here? What's your sense of just how easy it will be to accomplish that feat?
Well, I think it's pretty easy because basically the immigration minister can decide that this is a target that we want to welcome in Canada, and then the different consulate embassies around the world, they will accept this many people according to the policies that were put in place by the minister. So I do not envision that it would be hard. We saw that there was a big increase lately on the amount of people that were accepted and were granted visas. So we can do the opposite and then just refuse the visa by saying that they will likely not leave at the end of their stay in Canada, or that they don't meet all the criteria that they need to fulfill to get a visa. So it's pretty easy to refuse a visa.
Right. And quite a lottery for those on the other side hoping to get in, I assume, because all of a sudden they're going to find it more difficult.
Yes, that's correct. We've seen that in the past too, where it seems like everything is easy, and then at one point there's something that would change, and then nobody gets a visa anymore. So it's something that has been seen in the past, yes.
Right. Do you have a sense of where the majority of people are coming from when it comes to this huge surge we're seeing in temporary residents?
I'm not exactly sure for temporary residents. Exactly. I know for refugees that the top five countries have changed since Roxham Road has closed. But for the temporary student, I'm not sure. I see personally a lot of people from Africa. So many different countries in Africa that have been granted visas, a lot more than in the past.
How about the law of unintended consequences here? Because, of course, if you start to scale back the number of people being let in, there are universities and businesses and so on that will want to know where their students or where their workforce, their workers are, why they aren't here anymore. Is that possible? Is there a law of unintended consequences here?
I think the market is going to have to adapt, try to attract different people, different clientels. But of course, at the start, when there's new a lower amount of people coming in the country, that universities or workers, employers depend on, then they will have to change their way of recruiting those immigrants that they usually used to have a bit more easily. But I believe that they will just have to adapt and,
Chantal Iannicello is with us this half hour from Montreal. She's an immigration and refugee lawyer. We've been talking about Canada's population hitting 41 million today, according to the StatsCan population tracker. Most of that driven by temporary residents. Of course, Ottawa's announced that they're going to try and scale back on the number of temporary residents coming to this country. It's about 6.5% of the population now. They'd like to bring that down to 5%. Another thing that came up this week, it's been 1 year since the closure of that irregular border crossing between New York State and Quebec called Roxham Road. And I was curious to know, and this is one of the reasons we called Chantal in the first place, was to talk about what's happened since, because obviously that was a very popular crossing and then it was closed. Chantal, what's happened in the past 12 months then? Have you seen, obviously you've seen a real difference in where a refugee or asylum seekers are going?
Yeah, we don't see a difference in numbers, because that was the idea why the Roxham Road was closed, was with the intention of lowering the amount of refugee claimants that were arriving here in Canada. But when people are fleeing persecution, they will always find a way to escape their country and find a safe place. So we didn't see that happening. But what we saw is a difference in the top five countries that are coming in. So that changed. So where people come from. We also saw that the numbers of refugee claimants arriving in Quebec went down from about 64% to 40%. So now they tend to go elsewhere. For example, Ontario is getting a lot more refugee claimants than they used to have. And then we also saw that people are just arriving in Canada in a different manner that they used to come. So, for example, they are coming at the airport as students, temporary workers, or with any other type of visa, and they're just claiming inland, or they have to hide in Canada for at least 14 days before they can claim. So it didn't change the numbers of refugee claimants, but it changed who is coming in and how they're coming in and where they're coming from.
Yeah, I saw that Montreal's airport had about 10 times more refugee claimants in 2023 than it had in 2022, up around 30,000. I guess that means, I gather, Mexico now is the big one for people. Obviously, they didn't need visas, so it was easier for them to fly here, obviously.
Mexico was, it's correct, it's the biggest country producing refugees right now, but it will likely change in the next few weeks, because now they do need a visa to come here. So it is expected that Mexico, the numbers of Mexican claiming refugee is going to go down. And there's also now India, DRC, Senegal, and 80 is still in the top five as they were previous Roxham Road being closed.
There were a lot of predictions, I think, this time last year of a potential humanitarian crisis, where would people go and so on. Have we seen that?
Well, there's no humanitarian crisis, so that's a good news. I didn't hear stories as some people were afraid would happen, where people being hidden in houses and stuff like that. So that did not happen in large amounts anyways. But just people are creative in the way they come in, and they change their way to come in. It used to be more organized. So when people would come and present themselves on Wrexham Road, there was like fingerprints were taken. We were taking their passports. We were verifying if people had criminal files, etc. As for now, it is just a bit more difficult to know where people are. When did they come in? So entries are not as easily detected by authorities as they used to be when everybody was coming at the same port of entry.
Right. So ultimately, a good decision after a year, or not such a good decision, do you think?
Well, personally, I would think, as many immigration lawyers, it was easier to just have everybody come in at the same place and then be more organized and have some kind of arrangement, even if, you know, it was informal. But we had more control over who was arriving, where they were arriving from, who they were. As for now, people have to hide for 14 days, so it just creates different type of challenges that didn't exist before. It just seemed more human before as well, as now we have people crossing a bit everywhere, and I don't think that this is the right way to go, but you know, people will still come back. You can make walls, you can build fences, you can make laws, but if someone is fleeing persecution, they will find a way to come in.
Well, Chantal, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Let's head to Ottawa, because hearings have resumed at the federal inquiry into foreign interference there. At the root of the inquiry, of course, is to look into allegations of meddling in Canada's 2019 and 2021 federal elections. That was reportedly directed by China. The commissioner is Marie-Josée Hogue, and she says she will try to maximize the transparency of these hearings.
I am well aware that some people will feel that too much information is being kept secret, while others may feel that too much information is being disclosed.
Indeed, it is a delicate balance. Hogue says the public have a vested interest in knowing whether the democratic processes, our democratic processes, have been targeted by foreign actors. Now, the scope today, at least, and beyond, will extend beyond just China to other countries such as Iran and Russia. These hearings are the first to include testimony from diaspora groups and politicians. Today, people from the Iranian, Chinese, Russian, and Indian communities spoke about being targeted by foreign governments for speaking out on human rights issues. Yuri Novodvorsky of the Russian-Canadian Democratic Alliance says Moscow targets the relatives of Canadians who oppose the invasion of Ukraine.
Although many Russians are critical of Putin's regimes, they see that there are many risks to them speaking out in public about their views. And what this does, it helps Putin to maintain an image of a united and monolithic community.
Representatives of the Uyghur, that is China's Muslim minority, and Iranian communities also say that they feel foreign embassies in Canada are monitoring them and harassing their relatives back home. Hamed Esmailian, who you've heard on this show before, he is a spokesperson for the families who lost loved ones. He did too when Iran shot down a Ukraine Airlines plane in Tehran in 2020.
Every time we go to rallies, several members of the community, they wear masks, sunglasses, hats, to not be identified. There are reports that when they travel to Iran, their cell phones get confiscated, they get persecuted, interrogated. Their family members in Iran are under pressure.
Just some of the testimony from diaspora groups today at the inquiry. It will also hear from elections officials, CSIS Director David Vigneault, RCMP Commissioner Michael Duhem, and the Prime Minister as well. My next guest reporting, as I mentioned, has in many ways driven the calls and the reality of this inquiry that we're watching. Globe and Mail Ottawa Bureau Chief Robert Fife and Senior Parliamentary Correspondent Stephen Chase have spent years reporting on allegations of Chinese interference in Canadian elections and other issues surrounding foreign interference from other countries. They were awarded the Ross Munro Award for Excellence in National Defense and Security Reporting earlier this month for their coverage of the foreign interference story. So who better to weigh in today on what they thought of the first day of these public hearings and whether we'll get some of the answers that they've been looking for here. Robert Fife joins me now from Ottawa. Thanks so much for your time tonight. Welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Well, this feels like a long time coming, but here we are again, the redux of these public hearings with a new, obviously someone new in charge, Marie-José Hug. You were there today. What did you make of day one? Are we optimistic about what we might learn through this process?
Well, at the beginning, I wasn't so sure because Justice Hug spent some time saying there's lots of stuff we can't tell you, but we want to be as transparent as possible. And the reasons we can't, because some witnesses, their information has to be confidential because they're worried about being targeted. Some of the other information may be used in ongoing criminal investigations, but I will do everything I can to get as much information out to the public. We found out, for example, that she'd already had 6 days of in-camera hearings, which we think were largely dealt with the Attorney General's office. She said we'll get summaries of whatever evidence was presented, but we will not get no transcripts of it. So that means there was a lot of very confidential information involving national security. And then we had several hours then of bureaucrats talking about giving us a civics lesson on what an MP does and how an election is held and the role of the prime minister. And I thought, oh my God, we're in trouble here if this is the way this inquiry is going to go. But I will say that this afternoon turned out to be a really excellent session. We heard from activists, human rights activists for Uyghur Canadians, Chinese Canadians, Iranian Canadians, and Russians, and from the Sikh community. And the testimony was riveting. Each of these people were able to talk about, in the case of China, how they target and harass and intimidate people in the community, how they managed over the years to get control of Canadian Chinese community organizations, buying up Chinese language newspapers, how they use their consulates to intimidate and bully people. And this was surprisingly a very similar tactic that's being used by the other hostile actors, including India. The Sikh Canadian was very articulate in explaining that, you know, intelligence agents have been working out of Indian consulates in Canada since the 1980s, when many Sikhs fled religious and political persecution. And as you know, they have mainly settled in the GTA in Brampton and the Surrey area, but also in other Edmonton and Calgary. And, it looked the worst possible example, he said, of foreign interference is the fact that they felt they could go and kill a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil. And in the case, this was Harjeet Singh Najjar. And, one hopes that the RCMP will actually nab these guys and lay charges and find out who the other people that they had planned to kill as well, which we know from the U.S. indictment that there was at least four other people they wanted to kill in Canada. And then he outlined very much the similar, the kind of things that's happened with, to Chinese Canadians. You know, they used very good at disinformation campaigns. How they try to take over nomination leadership contests, where they are able to provide supporters and money. And it basically, as you know, nomination contests at almost any level are free-for-all. And that's where it's really important when governments like China or India can have a play a role, because they just get supporters and they get money. And they can have an impact in electing people to parliament or to the provincial legislature or to city council. So yeah. I think it was really good. But it was really the personal stories, too, about how they personally have been intimidated. You know, the Uyghur Canadian was very good about the fact that a number of times, as he led campaigns on genocide or forced labor, where he'd get these messages or phone calls saying that his mom and his sisters had died in China. And it was one of two things, how devastating that is to hear that. And secondly, all they knew where he was, and he was being monitored. This is a story that the Iranian Canadian had the same thing. He'd been suffered, endured social media attacks on him, verbal and physical threats to his life. And so there is something that these authoritarian governments are very good at doing, and they seem to take it out of the same playbook. And in Canada, you know, we're just so naive about what is actually going on. The Uyghur guy was asked by Justice Og, well, have you ever gone to the police and complained to them? He said, yeah, of course I have, but, you know, it's useless. They don't pay attention. They don't care.
Yeah, it goes to the heart of your reporting on this, right? I mean, ultimately, that's been the story. Again, what government knew when in the last few elections, I think, is infinitely important, but also just these personal stories that you've touched on many times over the past while covering this foreign interference story.
Yeah, I mean, what we need to know, because this inquiry is focused largely on, and she has a very short deadline of May 3rd, on foreign interference in the 2019 and 2020 election campaigns. What we need to find out is, because we know, we saw the classified, the secret and top secret documents, that these warnings went all the way up to the top levels of the government. In fact, even went to our own allies about the extent of Chinese involvement in trying to elect people that were not conservatives, because they didn't like the conservatives' view. They basically wanted to vote for the liberals. And those warnings went up to the deputy ministers, into the prime minister's office, into minister's office. I find that a little hard to believe that you wouldn't read that, but that's the answers we need to find out. Did the government turn a deliberate blind eye because it helped the liberals elect seats and defeat the conservatives?
After watching day one and knowing what you know now and having covered the story as much as you have and as well as you have, do you get the sense we're going to find out, get some of those answers at least?
I don't know that. I would like to think we would, but jury's out, my friend, on this one until we see more of the evidence and see what people are going to be saying. One thing she did say today, the commissioner, is that we will hear a testimony. They won't identify the names of CSIS officers, but we will hear testimony from CSIS officers who've been involved in some of this stuff. So hopefully, if these are the people who have helped do these investigations and write these reports, that would be enormously helpful. But we still need to find out what happened if it went up the food chain and why nobody apparently read the reports or bothered to tell anybody. You know, that's really important.
Globe and Mail Ottawa Bureau Chief Robert Fife is with us this half hour. We're talking about the public hearings at the Inquiry into Foreign Interference resuming today in Ottawa. We heard some testimony from those who are part of Canadian diaspora communities who found themselves targeted by different governments, including China and India and Russia and Iran. Bob, this comes at an interesting time because our allies are once again raising or sounding the alarm about some hacking activity that appears to be going on. China's foreign interference game doesn't seem to be lessening, despite all these stories coming out of different countries such as Canada, Australia, Britain, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, China has, from the latest news reports this week, the United States and the UK have charged and sanctioned China for extensive cyber hacking activities to try to influence election campaigns and to go after elected officials and to target people voting. And we subsequently learned that New Zealand had the same problem in Australia. It took us a little while to actually get an answer. It actually took us 2 days to get an answer out of the Canadian government. And they admitted, yes, the same actors who did these activities had also did it in Canada. No further details. But it's very frustrating, as you know, trying to cover politics in this country, certainly at the federal level, because there is an excessive secrecy. People can wait 5 years to get access to the information request back, and then it's not even answered. But to think that when all of our allies are able to say that, yes, China was involved in this activity, is why we couldn't say that is beyond me.
Yeah, well, I was seeing someone celebrate 5 years since they'd submitted a Freedom of Information request today. They had a little cake and candle for it. It was funny, but in many ways, it was very sad. Speaking of not having information shared particularly quickly, you've been digging into the story of these two scientists from our only sort of infectious level 4 infectious disease lab in Winnipeg, who were fired about 3-4 years ago. It turns out they're back in China, but we still don't know much about exactly what happened. I mean, we know a bit about what happened, but we don't know the full scope of it yet.
No, what we don't know, we know a lot now after 3 years of trying to get this information from the government, and they obfuscated and obstructed, and they wouldn't release the documents, and the speaker threatened to take the speaker to court, and then they called an election, and finally we got the documents, finally we got them released, we finally have a good idea of some of the activities that brought about the firing of these two scientists, they were working with, well, one of the scientists had done a patent in China based on information that we got from our level 4 infectious disease lab in Winnipeg. But, you know, she'd let in Chinese students. Her husband had given the passwords to the computers at the lab. And then he went off and did his own things. And there were military scientists there. She was doing work with military scientists, some of them not even telling anybody about some of the work that she was doing, including with the major general in charge of infectious disease and bio warfare for China, who had been lauded by President Xi Jinping. She had a bank account unbeknownst to anybody in China. CSIS found, hadn't been signed, but they found a contract that she was going to get for $1.2 million. So all of that information has come out, and nobody's ever, and the RCMP investigation, nobody's told us where they were. We finally able to find out that not long after they got fired, they scooted off back to China, where she is doing a lot of work with military scientists, and the husband's got himself another good gig as well there. But again, it comes down to this. Why is nobody being fired for this? Why was only the scientists who clearly were involved in some kind of an espionage activities? But why? Where were the bosses? Not one single boss has been fired. Opposition parties, including the NDP, frankly, and good credit to them, banded together this week and are going to hold hearings to try to get some answers on this. And not only why, how is this allowed to have happened? What steps have been taken to make sure it doesn't happen again? And the government tried to stop the committee's hearings from going on this week, but because it's a minority parliament, the hearings are going to take place. So that's a good thing. But this is something, when it comes to China, they don't seem to want to let Canadians know very much about what activities they're up to. As you know, the foreign interference inquiry, they fought that all the way until they had no choice but to call it.
It feels like the more you pull at these threads, Bob, the more you don't see a lot of accountability from up top.
You never seem to get any accountability. They're good at, well, even with the contracting, the outrageous federal contacting on RIVECAT and whatnot, they're happy to throw civil servants to the dogs who have been involved in this, but there's never any ministerial accountability. Like, all this stuff was happening under you, and you're completely blind to it. You're completely blind to Chinese interfering election campaigns. You're completely blind to the activities of rogue Chinese Canadian scientists at our most important infectious disease lab. You're completely blind to what's going on in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars of sleazy contracts that should never have been given to people who don't even have offices. They work out of their home and they make millions and millions of dollars, and they don't do any work. They just contract it out to somebody who knows how to do it and make cream off 30% of the profit.
Bob, as always, thanks for your time. We'll be looking for your reporting as this whole Foreign Interference Commission continues. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
My next guest is part of the Star Wars galaxy, and so is her husband. They're quite a famous couple. Amor Towles' international bestseller called A Gentleman in Moscow is coming to screens, small screens, later this week. It's an 8-episode series adapted from his 2016 novel of the same name. It stars Ewan McGregor, of course, who you'll remember from Star Wars and Trainspotting and dozens of other movies, in the lead role of Count Alexander Rostov. He's a Russian aristocrat who finds himself on the wrong side of history following the communist revolution more than a century ago now, and he's spared execution because it's believed that he wrote a popular poem praising the communists, which he didn't, but they believe he had. So he's instead imprisoned in an attic room at the opulent Hotel Metropole in the heart of Moscow. It still exists, actually. I've stood in the lobby where this story unfolds. Have a listen.
State your name.
Alexander Ilyich Rostov.
Occupation.
It's not the business of gentlemen to have occupations.
Your class is a threat against Russia. Therefore, it is the judgment of this committee that you be returned to the Metropole Hotel, where you will remain for the rest of your days.
Times have changed since our glorious revolution. Most of my friends are dead. My house was seized and burned.
You must never leave. If you do, I'll be waiting.
Well, thank you. You have carried out your duties with the greatest courtesy available to you.
She's an actress.
Ah.
I've seen her films. They're not very good.
I'm afraid they're quite ill-behaved.
I always think behavior is a matter of handling.
Yes, I'm sure you do.
Well, the last voice you heard there was the Count's love interest in this series. That's actress Anna Urbonova, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead. She's not only had a long career, beginning all the way back as a teenager in the show Passions, but through a series of successful horror movies, indie movies, including one that Canadians will know well, playing Ramona Flowers with Michael Cera in 2010's excellent Scott Pilgrim versus the World, set, of course, in Toronto.
Hey, what's up?
Nothing.
Hey, you know Pac-Man?
I know of him.
Well, Pac-Man was originally called Puck-Man. They changed it because... not because Pac-Man looks like a hockey puck. Paku-Paku means flap your mouth. And that they were worried people would scratch out the P, turn it into an F, like...
Yeah, that's amazing.
Am I dreaming? I'll leave you alone forever now. Thanks.
There you have it. Ramona Flowers, of course, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead. She was also in the Die Hard series, playing Bruce Willis's daughter in two of those films, 10 Cloverfield Lane, in the Star Wars series, Ahsoka, and in the TV series, Fargo. And that's where she met her now husband. They've been married for about a year. They have a young child who happens to be Ewan McGregor. So the couple are united for this series, which begins streaming on Paramount Plus on Friday. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Mary Elizabeth Winstead to the show now. Thanks for your time tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You know, I have to start off by saying that you know you're an honorary Canadian, right? So anybody listening to this will remember you, of course, from Scott Pilgrim. And, you know, do you still have fond memories of all that?
I do. You know, some of my closest friends to this day came out of that experience, and they are the cast members on the show who were the local Canadian actors are the ones that I sort of kept with me throughout my life since then. So I do feel like an honorary Canadian. My best friends are all Canadian. I love it.
It's interesting. There's a lot of us in Hollywood, I gather.
It's true. It's true. No, in a great way. It's the nicest people in Hollywood tend to be Canadian.
We like to think so. We like to think so. This is a really wonderful series. And it's interesting to see you because I actually watched Scott Pilgrim a few weeks ago. And it took me a moment to remember that that was the same person playing these two different roles, because the character you play in this series is very different and very interesting.
She is. She's fabulous. She's incredibly confident. She's a diva. She's a famous actress of the time, a famous sort of Russian movie star, silent movie star. And it was so much fun to get to step into her shoes and be that sort of brazenly confident and really kind of luxuriate in that. It was very juicy. It was great.
Yeah, Anna Urbonova is her name, and the Hotel Metropole, which I believe is still there. I think I've actually stood in the lobby of it in Moscow. You can't really afford to stay there, but it's a beautiful spot. Yeah.
No, I know. It's really interesting. I would love to see what it's like in person. I imagine it feels a bit different now than the version of it that we have in the show. But I'm sure that was interesting for you to get to see that depiction.
Indeed. How did this come about? Because I know, obviously, for listeners who don't know, Ewan McGregor is not only your love interest in the series, he's also your husband. You've been doing a lot of the promo work together, which is all. It must be nice. It must be nice to be partners in crime doing that as well.
It is. It's the best, really. we love hanging out together and working together. And so to be able to work together on a series that we both just absolutely loved. I mean, every day was such a joy to get the scripts and the scenes and these characters to play, and to get to do it together was like a real dream.
You, it's obviously based on a very well-known book. I gather, how did it come together in terms of, because I think I saw an interview that you both did at one point where Ewan was reading the book and sort of noticed that this Anna character might be perfect for you.
He was, yeah, he was reading the book. He had already signed on, I believe, to play the role based on the scripts that he was given. And so he was reading the book to kind of, you know, do his research. And he was just falling in love, you know, with the whole story and the count and the world that had been created in the book. And he just, you know, he'd be telling me about it. And then he'd be reading it and he would just sort of from across the room, he'd be going, oh, huh, sort of making big gestures so that I would notice and, you know, kind of telling me, oh, there's somebody very interesting in this book. You should read it. And so, yeah, from the get go, I was kind of hoping that Anna might be the right role for me, you know, in the eyes of the creators of the show. So I was very happy when it came my way and it turned out to be such an amazing role to play. I just felt so lucky.
Yeah. And it was just on a very superficial level, I gather that that Ewan had to grow an incredible mustache for this role that he had to keep for months, a year.
He did. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, he was growing it, you know, a beard with the mustache for many months before we started shooting. And then came the mustache era, which lasted many, many, many months as well. And it was really fun in the beginning because, you know, he was becoming the count. So he got a perm and he got the mustache and it was just fabulous. And then by, you know, month six, I was sort of like, it'd be great just to be you, for you to be you again. I started to look forward to that. But it was amazing while we were in the characters.
I was thinking, I mean, the character himself, Count Rostov, is sort of someone who's trapped in a hotel. And I thought that there might be few people, journalists will understand what it's like to live in a hotel for extended periods of time. And people in your business know what it's like to call a hotel home, right? As well, to some extent, there is a certain reality to it. Maybe not to the extent of which he's trapped in that hotel for decades on end, but certainly the idea of being sort of confined in a house that isn't home.
Absolutely. I think we can definitely relate to an extent to that. You know, I guess the difference is that we have the choice to leave when we want to. So the stakes really aren't there. But yeah, I mean, I don't mind when I'm working kind of being stuck at a hotel and having that, I guess, kind of simpler life where you just sort of go to work and then you come back and you just have your simple room and you focus on that and really nothing else exists for a time period. So there is like a certain pleasure to the simplicity of just having that one place to be.
Yeah, maybe not to be in prison there, but certainly, the choice to come and go always helps. Now, yeah. You were into ballet, obviously, growing up. Did you pay much attention to sort of things Russian culture, Russian plays, Russian books?
Yeah, actually, I do remember in my early ballet days as a child, you know, having an awareness and interest in Russian ballet and kind of knowing that that was kind of considered the sort of more strict form of ballet dancing. And, you know, kind of you just sort of learn all the different things that people look for. And if you're going with a choreographer who's from a Russian background, it's going to be a certain kind of experience. And so, yeah, I hadn't actually thought about that. And you've just kind of jogged my memory back to those days. But yeah, I think I did have an interest in that aspect of it. And I think this book really kind of, you know, helped me dive into that sort of Russian history in a different way. It really kind of wraps you up in it in a way that's really intriguing.
Yeah. What do you think for an audience now? Because this is a story that has been told in different ways in the past, but it's always interesting to see how it's updated for a new generation and a new era. What do you think people will walk away with after watching this movie set at a very different time? I think people may have seen Death of Stalin, which is a fantastic movie not that long ago. But this is something, what do you think people can walk away with from in this movie, in this series rather?
Well, I think there's certainly, you know, the intrigue of the historical history element of it. And I think that is something that people will find a lot, you know, in terms of the thought-provoking nature of that. But ultimately, it's about these characters and particularly the Count and his kind of quest for purpose in his life after he sort of loses everything and loses his sense of what he thought it meant to have purpose in one's life. And So I think there's something really hopeful about that, about going on this journey with him and seeing him find that and feeling the kind of weight of that emotion when he does. And I think that there's something really beautiful and old-fashioned about it, but through a more kind of modern lens. It doesn't feel like a stuffy old period piece, you know, it feels current in a way, but at the same time, it has this kind of sweeping, old-fashioned, epic saga quality that we don't get very often, you know, like a Dr. Zhivago or something like that. And so I think that to me is really special, but it doesn't feel far away like a lot of period pieces do. It feels very kind of close and personal, which I
Yeah.
think.
It's not stuffy in the least, which I thought was, and not that was surprising, but when watching it, it is not stuffy in the least. It is not one of those sort of stilted period pieces that one would associate with sort of watching movies from the 60s based on Chekhov plays, for instance.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, I think in that sense it feels current because it feels really emotionally like resonant. And so I think that hopefully will make people really connect with it.
Yeah, and just to prepare for the character itself, I mean, because the character that you play isn't exactly the character in the book, right? You've brought something a bit different to it.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, ultimately she is the character from the book, but we just get to spend a little more time with her. So we get
Right.
to understand her a little bit more deeply. Whereas in the book, I think she's very mysterious in a great way. She's sort of remains this mysterious figure all the way until the end. Whereas in the show, we get to kind of take a peek behind the curtain and see a little bit more about what makes her tick and kind of really get to know her vulnerabilities. And we get to be with her on her journey a little bit more than in the novel. So I was very grateful for that.
What's it like to go? I mean, a lot of married couples mightn't like to go to work every day for months on end, but I suppose in your case it's a little bit different because it is a project, right? And it has a beginning and an end.
Yeah, and also, you know, with what we do, we're often separated in a way. You know,
Right.
we have to go work in different places, and that's always really difficult. So to be able to even be at the same place at the same time for an extended period of time is always amazing, and even more amazing when we can be working together and acting together, which is one of our favorite things in the world. So it was amazing.
Yeah, obviously everyone asks you the Star Wars question, so I won't be the only one who doesn't. But there's a great story you tell about sort of being a Star Wars couple, and I believe your son refers to the Obi-Wan dolls as dad,
Yes.
which I
I don't
thought
think
was great.
he's never seen any of Obi-Wan, I don't think. So he doesn't really understand that it's a character. He just sort of thinks it's daddy dressed up in robes, you know.
And he loves Grogu, apparently, or
Loves
did.
Grogu. He still does. And now he's actually getting more into watching Grogu on The Mandalorian, whereas before it was just stuffed animals, but now it's kind of escalated to the actual show.
Right. And he met him in person. That's the other thing I was watching
He
as well.
did.
That
He
didn't
met
work out
him
so well.
and was terrified by him in person. But maybe one day we'll get to revisit that, you know, he could try again and maybe be less traumatized the next time, I hope.
Yes, indeed. Well, congratulations on a great series. I hope people tune in to watch. Mary Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Nice to talk to you.
To hear that another two whales have died, bring the total up to 17 in just 4 years. Enough is enough. It's time to shut this place down, and we're asking the Ontario government to step in before more animals suffer and die.
There you have it. There are renewed calls for accountability and closure at Marineland after two more beluga whales died at the embattled Niagara Falls, Ontario tourist attraction. Marineland has long been criticized for its handling of animals in its care, with even some, again, calling for the facility to be shut down. 16 beluga whales, one killer whale, orca, have died in the park since 2019. That, according to what the Canadian press has learned through freedom of information requests and other sources, a one bottlenose dolphin, one harbor seal, a gray seal, two California sea lions have also died during that time, the province has said. Now, the 63-year-old amusement park has been in the spotlight for decades and is facing ever-increasing criticism over how marine mammals and others there are treated. Marineland on its website says it has, quote, a strong record of providing for the welfare of its animals and will, quote, continue to prioritize their health and well-being. Phil Damaris was a trainer at Marineland in Niagara for more than a decade. He's now turned fierce critic of the operation. He joins me tonight from Niagara Falls. I think he can actually see the park from his balcony. Phil, thanks so much for your time tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Just to put this in perspective for those across the country who mightn't know that much about Marineland, this is a many whales that have died in a very short period of time.
Indeed. And if you stretch that span of time a little more, There's a lot more deaths beyond that track record. So some of the numbers that they're offering, in fact, don't include some unreported births of whales that also died. So the number is actually greater than is being reported.
Now, you worked there for a long time. I would suspect that people there in your position and so on probably have the best intentions. What's going on?
The water support system has been failing. This was my big criticism when I quit 12 years ago. It's what subsequently got me sued by Marineland Canada, was that the water system was failing. And that hasn't changed. And now the life support system and the tanks themselves have deteriorated so much that they can no longer sustain those whales.
I gather there's an investigation going on. Can you tell me a bit about that?
They don't call it an investigation. They specifically call it an inspection. And it appears that it gets nowhere. It accomplishes nothing. It is merely a record keeping of how many animals are dying because there's been exactly no consequences. There's been no charges laid. So it's beyond me in what capacity that those inspections are serving. But frankly, it's time something be done.
Just so listeners understand how the government is involved here in this operation, how is it that they are tied to this?
The Provincial Animal Welfare Society has been visiting Marineland upwards of, I believe it's twice a week or a month. There's a quote in one of the articles, but it's in excess of 175 visits. And amidst all of that, despite all of that, nothing's ever been done. Now, some bears, or rather, Marineland was charged with animal cruelty with regards to some bears, but again, that has nothing to do with the whales.
Right, and that was recent, right? I think that, if I remember correctly, that happened quite recently, that affair with the bears.
Correct. It would have made the news 2 weeks ago.
Right. So add this all up. What should be done then? How many marine mammals are left, or how many animals in these tanks are left now that would have to be moved if, in fact, they were to be moved?
We know of 34 beluga whales that remain. We believe of 4 dolphins. There's no way of confirming that until the dolphins are ultimately brought back out from their indoor facility when the summer months are, or rather when the park opens, if in fact it does. And then there's a host of seals and sea lions, but that number is undeterminable at this point, and a sleuth of land animals. So there's a lot of animals there, and, homes will have to be found. And sadly, for a lot of the land animals, I believe that's not going to be the case. So who knows what becomes.
You're also a resident of Niagara. I understand, I always remember the ads from back in the 80s. Obviously, it's been sort of an integral part of the Niagara landscape for a very long time. Is there resistance there to seeing this park go?
Oh, yeah. Attendance is abysmal. The park, we know it to be for sale. They're not operating with the purpose of being successful. There's no infrastructure investment. They're just operating amidst a very complicated and difficult and lengthy sale. So what the future holds for the animals and Marineland, no one knows. But Marineland, as we know it, is finished.
Right. There were some rumors circulating recently. I was reading some articles. I think you may have spotted them as well, or you may have seen the actual emails that suggested that it might not open this year.
I haven't yet seen the emails. I'm trying to track one down, but I have heard from multiple sources in multiple different places that employees have received that. So I believe it to be the summer employees that are typically being employed this time of the year. But Marineland has yet to announce a opening date. They've yet to announce any employment fairs, et cetera, all things that would have been done long ago at this point. So there's plenty of signs indicating that they themselves just don't know yet if they're opening.
Phil, tell me, when you went to work there originally, and this goes back a while now because it's been 12 years since you worked there and 12 years since you left, or you worked there for 12 years and it's been 12 years since you left. But at the time, there seemed to be a place for these kinds of places in the whole ecosystem. And it feels like over the past quarter century, a lot of people have changed their minds about sort of what we used to know as an aquarium or, a theme park that involved marine mammals.
Yeah. And we have to remember in the 25 years since when I worked there, when I started, These facilities were newer. So, you know, they've gone through a greater length of deterioration. And some of these facilities have been built since the 60s. In Marineland's case, we know that the sand filters were never changed in the stadium pools. And that's consistent with all the rest of the pools that were tanks that were built in the early 2000s. So the other thing is the industry itself was fairly young. I mean, the first whale in captivity was in the 70s. We didn't know a lot, you know, so as animals bred, as complications came and as things happened, we came to learn, especially with the internet now. People are able to see the animals in the wild, so it took away the message from the industry, which the industry used to, you know, pound on the customers and that, you know, you can't see these animals in the wild because it's too expensive. Well, that's debunked now. I mean, you can Google or plug into any live feed for that matter these days. So this, we're more educated. A lot has happened. When I worked there, frankly, over the course of my 12 years, I almost never heard any criticism from anyone. I'd never even, that conversation never really even came up. And it's astounding that in the 12 years since, it's, you know, entirely different.
Yeah. So what now? I mean, ultimately, the ball is in which court at this point? The province, I guess, is the one being asked to move in now?
Well, they need to do something. And I believe they need to seize those animals. And what I mean by seize is take custody of them. Have some third parties come in, independent third parties for assessments to determine, you know, what level of emergency situation this is and determine what is best for the animals. But it's going to take an outside effort, and that's not going to happen unless the government intervenes. And the provincial government is armed with all the laws necessary. In fact, the federal government as well. So this can't happen. Why it's not, I don't understand. But you know, I'm really hoping that you know, there might be some incentive to do so soon.
Well, Phil, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Let's stay on Vancouver Island, where I am right now, and let's continue talking about marine mammals. Experts are reconsidering a rescue plan for a young killer whale trapped by the tide in a remote lagoon off northern Vancouver Island. Sadly, the whale's mother died in the lagoon, and the tide is only high enough for the calf to get out for about 30 minutes a day. I mean, the window of opportunity, I gather, is about 30 minutes a day. Now the team leading the rescue mission is even considering a lift operation to get the young whale to the open ocean. Hadasat First Nation Chief Simon John, who's part of that rescue team, says they want to see the calf in the open ocean for a chance to reconnect with its pod.
My real concern is that the whale gets out of the lagoon safely and reaches its pod. And that's kind of where the real collaborative effort is related to. Basically, we're really trying to get to that point of actually getting it out of there.
There you have it, Simon, First Nation Chief Simon John. Rescue efforts were put on hold following several days of attempts to convince the calf to leave the lagoon on its own using recorded killer whale calls and so on. Joining me now from there is marine scientist Jared Towers. He's with Bay Cetacean. Jared, thank you so much.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So perhaps just catch us up on what happened today. What was the what were the efforts like to try and get this poor calf out this afternoon?
Well, up until this point, you're right. There have been a number of different attempts using playbacks and other methods like hukilau and also using some underwater deterrents, but nothing has worked so far. So today was a rest and regroup and rethink and give the calf a little break from all the interactions and spend some time on the water with it, just monitoring its behavior, as well as having an acoustic station on shore doing the same before coming back in tomorrow and the coming days to try a few more things.
Yeah. How is the calf? I gather it has a nickname as well. How is the calf holding up? It must be a really stressful time for it.
Well, we can only imagine. You know, it is a two-year-old calf, and it just lost its mother a few days ago. And that was some of our discussions around the nature of this situation really highlighted that this calf may be craving, and maybe we do need to give it a day of rest and maybe even more. We are, of course, concerned about its health, and time is of the essence. We're not going to be delaying too much along the way because, you know, a young killer whale needs to eat, and we don't think it is finding anything to eat so far at this point. But yeah, that's why we need to get it back out into open water so it can reconnect with some other orcas.
For listeners to understand just the geography of where you are and where this calf is and how mom ended up there, what exactly seems to have happened and why is it so difficult for it to leave?
Well, the first thing that happened was its mother and itself came in to the mouth of a tidal narrows, and they're quite likely hunting harbor seals in this area. There are a few around, and the mother regurgitated a part of a harbor seal during the stranding. And that later that day at high tide, the calf was still pretty close to her, but couldn't reach her because she was up on the highest part of the gravel bar. And it looked like from the drone that I was flying at that time that the calf was just trying to get as close to its mom as possible and navigating bravely through the shallows, and it ended up slipping over the shallow bar into the deep lagoon behind those tidal narrows. So once it's in there, it's got a lot of room to move around, and it's only got 30 minutes or so twice a day that it can get out during high tide.
Yeah. And clearly the complication here is trying to get it to go that way, right? Which mightn't be necessarily where it wants to be.
Well, yeah. And we've had fairly good success using the tools that we do have in similar situations with other killer whales. And in this case, for whatever reason, they just aren't working on this little one. And it may be just because it is so young and it's going through some things that some of the other killer whales that we've worked with haven't been going through. So for whatever reason it may be, it's telling us that it's not quite ready to leave yet. And at some point, we may have to, as you mentioned, lift it out and relocate it in that way.
Yeah. So listeners understand the attachment between mother and calf at that age. Two would still be relatively young for an orca calf, right?
Absolutely. You know, killer whales often stay with their moms for their entire lives. And in this case, the kid was only just over 2 years old and mother was still lactating. So it's probably definitely eating whole food by now, but could have been getting an extra bit of supplement from mother. I have no reason to believe that it couldn't reconnect with other killer whales and eat whole food consistently from this point forward. Because it is, you know, between the ages of 2 and 3, around the time we would expect a young killer whale to begin weaning. So, that's where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen images. The community's all come together. There's a lot of people there trying to make this work.
Absolutely, there's a lot of people working together from Fisheries and Oceans Canada, and the Habitat and Michalik First Nation, and my organization, Basitology. All on the ground here, as well as just local residents from Zabalas. And there's a lot of spirit and a lot of hope and a lot of gratitude amongst us all. And we're all here for the same reason, to give this calf the best chance of survival.
Right. For those who mightn't be familiar with different kinds of orcas, this would be a transient orca. Is that right?
Yeah, formerly known as transients, Biggs killer whale. And these killer whales only eat marine mammals.
Right. Well, Jared, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Sorry about that. So tell me a bit about what other options you have now in terms of you're going to try again tomorrow to try to see if you can't induce it to leave. But what other options do you have? How would a lift work?
Well, that's a good question. And there's a lot of preparation, a lot of forethought and lead time that needs to be in place for an operation like that to occur. You know, it would require more boots on the ground, more equipment in place. And, you know, we're not ready for that just yet. We want to give it one more push tomorrow using some acoustic deterrents and some boats in the water and just encourage that calf out over that gravel bar at high tide, using a bit of gentle force.
What kind of timeline do you think you're looking at then?
Well, that's a really good question too. You know, we know that young orcas can survive for a few weeks without food, and we don't want to leave it until this animal is, you know, weak and hungry. So in the coming days, if our current plans don't come to fruition and they're not successful, then, you know, there will be more consideration of a lift operation.
Do you have a sense of where its pod might be? Because obviously one of the challenges here is not just getting it to out of there, but also trying to reconnect it with its pod, right?
Yeah, well, the nice thing about this youngster is it's got a great voice. It knows the repertoire of its pod and its population, and it's making a lot of loud vocalizations. So another case where we had a three-year-old killer whale in a similar situation, we got it out and it reconnected with some other orcas, and now is a healthy young adult female, which is giving us a lot of hope and drive in this case. And it's not necessarily that this young orca needs to find its specific extended family. That's the hope. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, though, is that other big scale whales from other families may not be hesitant to take this one on for a little while until it can find its way and find its extended family. We know that its extended family travels in four different separate groups, and each one of those groups spends a lot of time off the west side of Vancouver Island. So it's quite likely when it does meet up with other orcas that it will be animals it's related with. And if not, there's still a good chance that we could adopt it, at least temporarily.
Yeah, they're amazing creatures that way, I mean, needless to say.
Well, they are. I mean, they're very evolved. They are at least as evolved as we are. And we share many physiological and intellectual traits with these animals. They are amazing, and they continue to surprise us all the time.
Yeah. So what does tomorrow bring then? What is job number one tomorrow?
Well, I think we need to have a few discussions and carry on where we left off tonight with our plans for the day and just see where it takes us. You know, the time that we will be getting together is going to be around high slack when we actually make our efforts. And there's a bit of logistical things that need to take place. I personally need to, you know, get two more boats here on site. We've got a few more coming, and yeah, tomorrow, like I said, is going to require some boats on the water, and so yeah, there's going to be a bit of mobilizing around that.
Well, Jared, best of luck to you and everyone there with this. Thanks so much for your time tonight and filling us in on what's going on.
Okay, you're welcome.
We're finding out more today, or at least a little bit more, about what happened in Baltimore yesterday. Divers were back in the water under the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge looking for the bodies of six members of a construction crew, with reports that the two of them were found, of that road crew, were found in a vehicle late today. You may remember we did a lot on this last night. A huge container ship, the Dali, appears to have lost power just before 1:30 a.m. Tuesday local time, before ramming right into the bridges, one of the bridge's key pillars, causing the entire structure to crumble within seconds. Now, amazingly, and this has been talked about, crew members on the boat managed to sound the alarm, saying the ship had lost power, was heading towards danger, giving authorities time to stop traffic. And today, what was released was sound of first responders, thanks to Broadcastify, at the Key Bridge in Maryland leading up to the collapse. Have a listen.
There's a ship approaching. It just lost their steering. So until you get that under control, we got to stop all traffic.
Yep, we're all on the route to the south side.
I'm holding traffic now. I was driving, but we stopped prior to the bridge. So I'll have all out of the traffic stopped.
10-4, is there a crew working on the bridge right now?
K-9-1, but they know.
Good.
Let me stop traffic on this site right now.
Yeah, if we can stop traffic, just make sure no one's on the bridge right now. I'm not sure where, if there's a crew up there, you might want to notify whoever the foreman is, see if we can get them off the bridge temporarily.
10-4, once the other unit gets here, I'll ride up on the bridge. I have all interloop traffic stopped at this time. Once you get here, I'll go grab the workers on the Key Bridge and then stop the outer loop.
C-13 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Start is whoever, everybody. The whole bridge just collapsed.
There you have it. And you can see there that they were aware that there were people on the bridge still, that work crew was there and hoping to get to them. In fact, that's where one of the officers was headed. And suddenly it was too late. I mean, we know the bridge collapsed very quickly after collision. It looked like it happened in about 40 seconds. The fact that they managed to stop traffic invariably saved more lives. We could be talking about an even worse tragedy today. There's been a lot of talk tonight, or all in the last 24 hours, a whole lot of talk about the vessel itself, this giant container ship, 299 meters long, 100,000 tons. It was headed from the port of Baltimore, fully loaded, appeared with containers on its way to Colombo in Sri Lanka, about a three-week trip. It is a registered in Singapore. It flies a Singaporean flag. They'll be involved in the investigation as well. And they're trying to figure out exactly what went wrong. Now, today, apparently, it was revealed that it had passed foreign port state inspections in June and September of 2023. The boat did. And Singapore's Port Authority says that it did an inspection in June of 2023 that revealed a faulty monitor gauge for fuel pressure that was rectified before the ship left port. The U.S.'s NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, is leading this investigation, and its chair, Jennifer Hammendy, says they have retrieved data from the ship that hit the bridge.
We do have a download from the voyage data recorder that we've sent back to our lab to evaluate the data and begin to construct a timeline of events, which we hope to have later today.
Now, of course, a lot of focus on the ship and what caused it to lose power, causing it to slam right in. It was a direct hit on one of the key pillars holding up this bridge. So many engineers have said that it didn't really stand a chance, given the size and force. It was going about 15 kilometers an hour, 8 knots when it hit, that this bridge stood very little chance of surviving. But it was built back in 1977. How did it collapse so quickly, this 2.5 kilometer long bridge? The governor, Wes Moore, said in a news conference yesterday that it was up to code, that the ship appeared to have hit a main concrete pier, which rests on soil underwater and is part of the foundation, thus what the catastrophic result of it. But the bridge also, and this was reported by the New York Times today, didn't have an obvious fender system or protective barriers to redirect or prevent a ship from crashing into the piers. Again, here is Jennifer Hammendy saying that they'll be looking into the structure of the bridge as well.
Part of our investigation will be how was this bridge constructed? It will look at the structure itself. Should there be any sort of safety improvements? All that will be part of our investigation. We go very broad in our investigation.
Indeed. So was the bridge's design part of the problem here? Could there have been more security to protect those pillars from being hit? And what could it mean for Canadian bridges that could similarly be in harm's way? Stephen North Van was just pointing out that the Lions Gate Bridge in Vancouver's had some near misses over the years. Well, joining me now is Elena Dragomirescu. She's an associate professor in the Department of Civil Engineering at the University of Ottawa, who does work on the structural reliability and risk assessment of bridges. Elena, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I guess a lot of people who don't know what you know would have watched those images first appear and wonder how such an immense structure could crumble so quickly.
Well, it was a surprise for everybody. It was a tragedy, first of all. Mm-hmm. But in the same time, we realized that a bridge without a pier cannot survive. It will collapse. And for such a massive collision, it had no chance.
Yeah, I think that's been sort of the consensus, that given the circumstances and the force with which it struck and where it struck, the structure itself really didn't stand a chance. Were you surprised at all by what I think looks to have been maybe a lack of protection for this particular pier, given where it was?
I wouldn't say I was surprised. I somehow know that basically this is not the first collision. So when initially the bridge was built in 97, well, actually was opened to public in 1977, and that was actually in 1980s, we had a similar incident in Florida, the Sunshine mm-hmm. Skywalk Bridge, and that collapsed because of a collision with a ship. Well, a few months after that collision, a small boat actually collided with the pier of this bridge, Key Bridge in Baltimore. And at that time, the protection worked. So for a smaller boat, for a smaller collision, that kind of protection, concrete protection around the piers would work. In this case, however, the massive collision was impossible to actually resist such a power. Thinking like 95,000 tons, we cannot imagine how powerful this is. One of my graduate students, Mr. Etienne Noel, made a preliminary calculation, and that means about 1,500 Honda Civic traveling at 100 kilometers per hour crashing into that pier.
All at once, all at the same time, right?
All at the same time.
In a very sensitive part. I mean, there were only two that were holding this thing up, right? So you take one away. Yes, I mean, I think that's been talked about a lot as well, given when this bridge was built and designed and so on in the early 70s and opened in 77, that it hadn't really foreseen the size and power of something like the Dali.
That is correct. But even if they would have foreseen it, the solution is not a structural one, because even if we build a pier strong enough to support, to sustain such a collision, would be a really unreasonable dimension. So we would have buildings, or the size of a building would be a pier for such a bridge, which will obstruct even more the navigation in the area. So we have to actually perform some analysis to see how big that pier should have been to actually withstand that collision. But again, I expect that is not a reasonable dimension that we would get. And actually here I have, the help of my graduate students, Mr. Etienne Noël, who's leading the team.
I suppose then, I mean, this is looking quite far ahead at this point, but when they rebuild, they would basically have to look at a different design, right, for this bridge?
Absolutely. A suspension bridge would have a better clearance, in the sense that this bridge had the main span, which is used actually for navigation where the ships can pass. It was 366 meters. And for a truss bridge, this is long. This is the third longest in the world. Mm-hmm. But in the same time, to have even a longer span, like just a clearance between two piers, nothing in between, the ships can actually navigate freely, then we have to change the type of structure. We would look at suspension bridge, cable stayed bridge, and that's pretty much the options we have.
Obviously, in this country, eyes have turned then to those bridges that might be somewhat similar, or in, you know, in areas that feel similar. We think of Vancouver, we think of Trois-Rivières in Quebec, or perhaps Halifax. Have you looked at all at, you know, obviously everyone was out yesterday to try to reassure Canadians that, you know, our bridges are safe, but clearly that's something that's on a lot of people's minds today.
So the bridges are safe. And of course, as long as they don't have a collision of this scale. We do have protection for most of the bridges, smaller scale of protection. But again, for such a massive collision, we cannot actually predict and build a massive column as a pier to withstand it. But in the same time, we did rely for so many years on the navigation system, and we would rely to say that it is safety. What I would actually look at would be a better communication between the harbor staff and the engineers. Mm-hmm. Because if the engineers would have realized how difficult it is to navigate a big cargo ship in that region, they would have actually looked at something, an alternative.
Right, which it's hard to imagine. I mean, I think what we may find, and this is pure, I mean, not to speculate too much, I think we may find there was a cascading number of catastrophes that happened to this ship, and all of it happened at a time where it couldn't possibly maneuver out of the way. So you end up, you know, like in many plane crashes and so on, you end up with sort of a perfect storm.
It was indeed, but we don't know what happened, and we cannot blame on one side. We don't know what was and how difficult it would be actually to deviate such a big ship. We do not know what it takes. The investigation is on its way, so we just have to wait for the results. Yeah.
But in your sense, almost no bridge built that way would be able to withstand what happened to the Key Bridge yesterday.
No bridge would have, even a new bridge. So this is a 1977 built bridge, but even a newer bridge, if it would have been constructed yesterday, still would have crashed under the same circumstances.
Right. So really, it's down to the design. You need to build something that has that's a different design to give more clearance for those ships to go through.
That would be a logic solution for us. But the issue is we would have done it even earlier if we knew. And even if we build, let's say, a wider bridge, that means a longer span with better clearance, we still have to worry about the collision with the piers. Right. So we cannot say that we just opened the span and now we made it 1 kilometer apart, the two piers, and we are worry-free. We still have to protect those piers.
Right. And do you think enough is being done to protect them? I mean, I guess a lot of it depends on the structure of the bridge itself and so on. There are many different bridges around. I know there's one that's quite similar to the Key Bridge in Trois-Rivières, actually across the St. Lawrence. I mean, I suppose it's a question of individual authorities looking at each individual bridge and trying to make them as resilient as possible.
Yes, we do that. But in the same time, we have to look at all the conditions around that site. So we have to look at the volume of navigation. We have to actually determine the probability of in the return period of those kind of events. And then we design with the vulnerability index in mind in such a way that each bridge would have a different safety index only in terms of return period for such extreme events. And in this sense, we do apply protection for the piers, protection for smaller piers colliding, or actually on the prediction to collide with smaller ships. We do have concrete structures around. We do have sometimes small islands of rocks, but again, not for such a massive collision.
Right. It's a very, I mean, the way you look at a bridge must be different from how most of us look at a bridge, right? You're actually looking, you're doing a risk assessment when you look at a structure like that, thinking what could go wrong.
However, the limitation we have is that we look internally. So we are just dealing with forces like earthquake, wind, traffic, whatever happens on the bridge. We do actually calculate collisions, but on the bridge between trucks and what would happen, how would affect. And we do actually calculate those forces and see the impact on the traffic. But we do not have enough actually investigations to see and methodology to see what would happen on the piers. On the piers, we are worried about the hydrodynamic forces, the ice, and all other. But we did not consider a massive collision like this. So I think it's time to actually intervene. At least we should know how massive should be a pier, how big should be a pier to withstand which type of collision. So we should actually make a classification. And based only on that, especially for harbors like this, who actually need what is needed, such a classification. And based on that, we should just give an index for the bridge and say this is usable for these conditions. And this is where I say that the communication between engineers and the harbor staff, it's important. Because we do not know, if we would have knew how difficult it is actually to steer that that ship and such a big cargo ship in general through 300 meters apart piers, then we would have tried already to solve or to propose a new solution, but we didn't realize.
Yeah, it's interesting that we don't look at it that way, because clearly one of the biggest dangers to a bridge like that would have been a ship strike, right? I mean, in the balance of probabilities, maybe not, but you couldn't imagine it, you know, you could imagine it happening.
That's exactly the point. And I mean, in this sense, many other probabilities could actually be involved, a terrorist attack or a plane landing or force landing. Or so many other extreme events like this can be taken into account. But we have to actually acknowledge the fact that the more we take into account, the more expensive the bridge is going to become, because structurally, the heavier and the bigger the members of that bridge will be. And that involves many other factors of decisions.
Right. And, I mean, there is a cost risk analysis that goes on in all these situations, obviously.
Because these bridges are built right now, we have experience. So from 1950s until now, we have experience in building these bridges in such a way that they are safe, structural integrity is achieved. And also it's a cost, well, a reasonable cost for the given structure. Because even if you look at these piers, they were not massive piers up to the deck. They were actually dividing into four columns and also very slim four columns, which were supporting the deck. But for the deck perspective, that was sufficient with the traffic and everything. For a collision perspective, obviously, we have now the proof that was not.
Elena Dragomirescu is with us. She is with the University of Ottawa. She does work on the structural reliability and risk assessment of bridges. Elena, I suppose this has also been a wake-up call for all the other infrastructure in this country, because as you mentioned, ship strikes, even when it comes to constructing bridges, is sometimes not front of mind. There are many other concerns with the infrastructure in this country, you know, including highway overpasses and so on. Sometimes it feels like we don't pay enough attention to the infrastructure that exists around us and that we rely on every single day. And this is, in Baltimore, is yet another reminder of how sensitive it can be.
That is true. And it's sensitive, it's vulnerable. But in the same time, we rely so much on monitoring these structures and actually performing inspections, regular inspections. However, not always we can catch all the faults. So damage induced by corrosion, by fatigue, the cracks, manufacturing errors. So all these are actually hidden in any kind of deck. So it is possible actually to have accumulation of those damages. And then we have to look and see what can happen. Even without a collision, we do have a risk of collapse. And we have seen this with Concordia Overpass in Quebec. So we do have to be alert, and actually we do spend a big part of the budget on, and not our budget, is the governmental budget, but we do spend part of the budget in actually maintaining these structures.
Right. As we saw with the Champlain Bridge in Montreal that they eventually had to replace. I mean, these are huge expenditures, right? And therefore, oftentimes, I mean, I assume something like the Key Bridge in Baltimore was only 50 years old. I mean, replacing those bridges out of a concern for safety, it can be not necessarily a tall order, but it is definitely expensive. And there can be pushback against that from people who may not think it's quite as dangerous as others do.
That is true, but in the same time, we cannot risk. We would better replace it. And we have to keep in mind that if we reach the life cycle of a bridge, which is, well, around 75 years, then we do have to think of the option of actually replacing the bridge or actually repairing the bridge. What happens is with every repair we perform on a bridge, we extend that life of the bridge. However, the more it is ignored, the probability of actually having to take down the bridge and build a new one, of course, the expense involved, then that is actually the solution. And we have now a situation here in Ottawa that Alexandra Bridge, it's currently closed to traffic. Mm-hmm. They opened the truss and they saw indeed it's a major rust problem they have. Now we are just looking at possibilities of replacing or repairing the bridge. We'll see what the decision will be finally.
So I suppose as we all look to Baltimore and try and find answers as to what went wrong there yesterday, it's an opportunity to look at a lot of other infrastructure and just be reminded that, you know, bad things can happen. The worst can happen sometimes.
It can, but we have to be ready. One way or the other, we have to be ready. It would have been a matter in a collapse in a few seconds or in a few minutes.
Elena, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Canada is running low on maple syrup. At least our maple syrup reserve is way, way down. That's right. A few bad years has offset a bumper crop a few years back. So our strategic reserve, which is held in Quebec, that province accounts for 75% of global production of maple syrup, is now down to just a fraction of what it once was. It is a trio of vast warehouses, by the way. You may have seen images of it when there was that big heist that happened a while back that caught everyone's imagination. It seems like stories about maple syrup, and especially the reserve, are worldwide. People pay attention to them absolutely everywhere. So again, with the reserve running low, it's not just Canadians taking notice. Even TikTokers are.
Hey Canada, what's going on with you?
We're running out of maple syrup.
What do you mean? That's the only thing that you have that you make well. Mind you, we make a lot of good stuff.
But yeah, our maple syrup reserve is at a 16-year low.
But why is that?
The weather, man. It's too warm.
Like, is it that low now? Back in 2020, there was like 103 million pounds. Now it's 6.9 million. Okay, that's a huge drop.
Yeah, like our whole identity is this thing and we're running low on it.
Yeah, sorry Canada. You should look for other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty basic looking TikTok video, but that's how much this gets paid attention to. So what's going on? He was right. The harvests have not been as great the past few years. Experts say climate change is playing a role in that. Demand is up. And so the reserve is down just 6.9 million pounds last year when it was built to hold 133 million. And in 2020, it had more than 103 million. So it's near empty, more or less. Simone Doré-Ouellette is the deputy general manager of the Quebec Maple Syrup Producers. They are in charge of that reserve, and he joins me now. Simone, thank you.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me.
Interesting. I mean, I knew this would happen at this time of year because my dad's still in Quebec, and he was sort of talking about how warm the winter was and how the sugaring off season was starting a little early and so on. But it has been a warm winter, and it's not the first one in the past few years.
No, it's not the first time that we're seeing a warm winter, although what was really unusual this year about what we've seen so far is that the production started early pretty much everywhere all across Quebec. So in some regions in which you generally don't start producing maple syrup before the end of March, well, they have had their first maple runs in February. So that was quite unusual.
Right. Tell me a bit about just how this winter would impact then overall production, because I gather it's quite a delicate dance, as they say. You need sort of temperatures to be a certain way, cold at night, slightly warmer during the day, for this all to work perfectly.
Yeah, well, what essentially drives sap flow in maple trees is daily temperature swings. So generally speaking, production is at its peak when sugar grove is under freezing conditions during the night and warmer conditions such as 5 to 10 degrees Celsius during the day. So when these swings are more frequent or numerous during the spring, chances are that the producer is going to have a better season than. The longer the season is, the better for overall production in general.
Right. How has production been then the past few years? Because looking through some of the stats, it looks like demand is really high and production is somewhat struggling to keep up.
Well, it really does depend. So we have seen some smaller crops in 2021 as well as in 2023, but 2022 was a record year in terms of production. So we have seen large differences in yields going from one year to another. This is not also unusual. Maple syrup producers have been dealing with this for a very, very long time now. But we can expect that with climate change, these large swings in yields from one year to another are going to be more frequent, and we have to account for these fluctuations for the future.
Right. Of course, for listeners who don't know, Quebec is incredibly important, not just for the Canadian maple syrup market, but for the maple syrup market, right, worldwide.
That's right. We produce almost 75% of the world's production of maple syrup. So when things are more difficult in Quebec in terms of production, well, you see some impacts everywhere. And that's kind of why we have the strategic reserve that we can rely on for smaller crops so that we can still supply the markets even in small years of production.
Right. People are always fascinated by the maple syrup strategic reserve, but that's precisely what it is, right? You're basically trying to hedge for the years where there isn't as much supply, and yet demand seems to stay the same. Tell me a bit about the reserve. It seems to be, it was up around 100 million pounds in 2020, then it was down to the mid-30s the past few years. Now it's down even lower than that. Is it in trouble of depleting?
No, not at least in the future. So while the strategic reserve it's standing at the low level right now, we do not foresee any supply issues for the near future. The sugar inventories are lower right now due to sustained growth of global demand of maple syrup, but also to the fact that we have had two smaller crops in 2021 and 2023, as well as the fact that private inventories of maple syrup, so private inventories that are in the packers' warehouse are being maintained at a higher level than they have been in the past. So to make sure that we have a strong and reliable strategic reserve, so we have issued 14 million new taps that were offered to new and existing producer so that they will be able to tap more trees and help us replenish the reserve over the last 3 to 4 years.
Right, because you mentioned it, and I don't know whether Canadians are fully aware of this because we're so used to seeing maple syrup on our shelves that the demand for it has increased, and part of it's been purposeful on the part of your organization to try and grow the worldwide demand for maple syrup for Canadian Quebec maple syrup.
Yeah, that's right. So producers collectively have been investing in generic promotion in different markets, such as the US, the UK, Australia, Germany, Japan. Packers have also been investing themselves to make sure to make the attributes of maple syrup more well known, also show consumers how to use maple syrup in their recipes and adopt maple syrup. It's really great because when it comes to sustainability, maple syrup has we have a really amazing story to tell about maple syrup, and that really drives people towards our product more and more. So we've seen that growth in terms of export since 2014. On average, in a yearly measure, we have seen exports grow around 6.5% per year, which is quite phenomenal for a sector such as ours.
Right, of course, but with that demand, once you start to build that demand, you need to keep the supply going, right? Or that demand risks kind of falling off if they can't get their hands on it, which must be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, it's always we always have to plan for the long term. That's why we have collective marketing tools such as the strategic reserve, but also the quota to ensure that we're always keeping up with demand, with the supply, having the right balance.
Simon Doré-Ouellette is Deputy General Manager of the Quebec Maple Syrup Producers. We're talking about the maple syrup season. It has, of course, begun. It's started a little early this year even because it's been a warm winter in Quebec. Quebec produces about 75% of the world's maple syrup, so it is important. Demand has been up over the last decade quite significantly because there's a lot of marketing going on. And supply, I mean, the reserves, you may have heard of the Strategic Maple Syrup Reserve. There was a robbery there about a decade ago that captured a lot of attention. But it is, in fact, there to make sure that when times are a bit lean, that the supply stays fairly consistent. It's pretty low right now, though, down at 7 million pounds from about 100 million about 4 or 5 years ago. Simon, I was in Île d'Orléans or near Quebec City in the summer. And of course, my memories of the maple patch, of the sugar patch, was like the old spigots in the trees with the metal cans. And then now there's these huge systems of like vacuum set up, and it looks a lot more high tech than it used to. It must be changing in some ways, reacting to this increased demand and to the fact that the climate is changing a bit as well.
It has really changed. And I think marketing tools, the collective marketing tools that we have here in Quebec, have allowed this technology shift to happen. So the environment, the business environment, is more predictable, which has allowed producers to invest more in their maple groves in terms of how they collect maple sap, but also how they transform it to turn it into syrup. So technology has changed a lot. Producers are getting more and more concerned about climate change and are trying to do their best to reduce greenhouse gas emissions coming out of their facilities. We know that our maple groves capture way more carbon than the activity of producing maple syrup generates, but still producers are concerned, are turning towards new energy, new sources of energy for their evaporators. More and more, they will be concentrating the sap before it gets to the evaporator, so that we need less energy to produce maple syrup than we used to need.
Yeah, and it just feels like it's very much something that was very static for a very long time. Feels like it's very much entered the 21st century now in terms of the production, the way it looks, the way it works.
Yeah, maple syrup production is still dear to our heart and holds. It relates to a lot of family memories. But what we have been seeing in the maple groves and the sugar shacks is a major shift in terms of the use of technology to really try to be more efficient and to be able to respond to the growing demand for the product in the most sustainable way possible.
Right. When we look at the store shelves, because I think Canadians are used to seeing maple syrup from Quebec or from Ontario on their store shelves at this time of year, or all year for that matter, what could the possible impact be on the sort of the cost for the average Canadian consumer right now, with strategic reserves low, with demand globally higher or getting higher, and sort of this unpredictable 2024 season?
Well, the strategic reserve level has no impact on the price of maple syrup paid by buyers or packers. Maple syrup producers will not receive a better price than what was negotiated and agreed upon with the buyers and the packers more than 2 years ago for this year's production. So it shouldn't really have an impact. The reserve doesn't have an impact on prices, although producers do not control how prices are transmitted in the supply chain. Right. So we can't really comment what's going to happen in terms of prices on grocery shelves.
Right.
But for sure, it wouldn't be related to the strategic reserve.
Right. From your side, the price stays the same.
That's exactly right.
Right. But predictably, or perhaps in the future, that this could have an impact. We see that a couple of short years. We don't really know what 2024 is going to look like just yet, do we?
No, we don't. So far, the production has been plentiful. So we're encouraged to see what we are hearing the production year looks like. We also know that the weather forecast across Quebec is quite interesting for the next few weeks. So we're really hopeful that we're going to have a good to great season this year.
Right. And I guess everyone always asks you about the security of the reserve after what happened 10 years ago, right? I mean, it's been the story that never went away, that theft.
Yeah, we do get some questions from time to time on that. But for us, it's a topic that's we're well beyond.
It's old news.
It's old news. That's right.
Simon, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for yours.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.